Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Film Stage Show, the one and only official podcast of thefilmstage.com. Really can't speak if there are any unofficial ones out there, but if there are, please stop. With us today to discuss the newest film by Steven Soderbergh, Side Effects, is, of course, Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hi.
Hey. Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
Hello. And a special guest, Ethan Vestby, who sometimes writes for The Film Stage.
That's me.
All right. So now you know which voice is Ethan's. Before we get into our feature review of Side Effects, a couple of housekeeping things. Make sure to sign up for make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, drop us a comment and a rating. And if you ever have need to talk to us, you can always do that at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Before we get into our feature review of Side Effects, we will be talking about the life and times, the full career and filmography of Steven Soderbergh, the director of Side Effects. And because we are such gentlemen, we will let Ethan start us off. So Ethan, what are your thoughts on the prolific director, Steven Soderbergh?
Well, I think Soderbergh's interesting, and I don't want to speak for everyone here, but I feel like there's kind of been this sentiment recently, at least, where he's kind of become popular again. Like, I feel like he was a filmmaker for a while that everyone was like, oh, yeah, Steven Soderbergh. Yeah, I like him. Yeah. And he would sort of, like, put out a movie or so every year, and people were like, oh, yeah, I'll go see it. Yeah. But I feel like kind of, as of late, I feel like he's been on a real hot streak, and he's really been in the news, and his films have really been discussed a lot. I don't know maybe if it has anything to do with his retirement, but I think it's interesting, too, because he's a guy whose career had certain stages. Like, he started out as the art filmmaker, and then he had all these bombs. And then he was like, okay, I've got to do something kind of mainstream. That put him back on the map. Then it seems like he sort of went into an art film phase again. But I guess he still had the Oceans franchise. And again, like I said, they liked him but weren't super enthusiastic about him. But now that, as of late, he's sort of been doing a lot more mainstream films, and it's put him back on the map again. So I think he has a pretty interesting career.
And Nick, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree when it comes to the different phases of his career. He started out with Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which is, you know, I would say, I think many would agree, the most influential, probably the most important independent film of the last 30 years. And then, yeah, he hit that poor streak, even though he was making very good films like Kafka and King of the Hill and Grey's Anatomy as well. But after those were kind of coming and going. I didn't mention The Underneath because that movie's not very good, but it's there anyway. He hit that real sort of the problem period of his career, and then he made Schizopolis, which is kind of his way of doing an artistic shake-off in a way. And then he was able to kind of recalibrate, and he did Out of Sight, which, like Ethan said, put him back on track. And the last, I would say, 12 years of his career have been just really fascinating because he won the Oscar for directing Traffic the same year he was also nominated for Aaron Brockovich, and then he went into the Ocean series. But then you look at his career after that, in the same year he did Full Frontal and Solaris, both movies which have very big stars in them but are very esoteric and non-mainstream, and a lot of people just don't like them for those reasons. And then he'd go back and do something like Ocean's 12 or even The Good German while he was doing something like Bubble or The Girlfriend Experience or Che, these movies that would get very limited releases. And it seems like a decent amount of people would see them, especially considering that these are quote-unquote art house pictures. But he would kind of, I don't know, they feel sort of more like him laying low in a certain way. And then in the past, I guess it would be really only the past couple of years is when he's been sort of having what is referred to as this mainstream resurgence with things like Contagion and Haywire and, of course, Magic Mike, which was a huge hit and sort of had its own weird place in the popular culture for a bit. Really like no other Soderbergh film. And it's interesting that he's going out now when he's kind of at this popular peak with his career. Even more so with something like Ocean's 11. This is, I mean, he has three straight films that have either been hits or have done basically well. And that's not really something that you'd ever expect from him, considering he sort of mastered the one for them, one for me system that you see other filmmakers like Gus Van Sant navigating their way through the Hollywood waters with. So, it's a career that I think we'll look back on in 50 years and just sort of try and figure out how exactly it happened, because there is like no other that I can think of.
Yeah, that's a you make an excellent point about looking back and just wondering what on earth happened. But Danny, what about yourself?
Yeah, just to kind of go off this point about these different phases of his career, I was reading a few interviews with Soderbergh this past week, and I think it could have been the one over at MUBI with Ignaty Vishnevetsky, where Soderbergh mentioned how a big kind of shift in his career was when he stopped writing his screenplays. And I think that actually kind of answers a lot of questions about maybe how his career has kind of grown more and more successful. If you look at like Out of Sight, which was kind of the film that saved him financially and critically,
I was going to say when he stopped writing his screenplays too.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't write Out of Sight. He didn't write The Limey. He didn't write Traffic. And, in these last few years, he's developed a relationship with Scott Z. Burns. He's reteamed with Lem Dobbs. And I think that something about him, you know, not having to write his screenplays and just focus on directing, cinematography, and editing has really brought out something really exciting in his movies, and something that's obviously spoken to a larger audience, because I'm at least grateful for the kind of higher profile resurgence he's had, because I know a couple of years ago I wasn't that familiar with his films, but him sort of cracking into the semi-mainstream again kind of convinced me to go back and watch all of them. And it, you know, as both of you said, it really is a fascinating filmography. One of the things that's interesting to me is I would consider Soderbergh kind of one of my favorite directors. And yet when I think of, if someone were to ask me what's my favorite film of his or what's the greatest film he's made, I don't know if I'd have a quick answer. And I don't even know if I could say if any of his films are just kind of like, if he has a masterpiece or anything like that. When I think of a lot of my favorite directors, I could tell you right away which of their films I think are kind of amazing, all-time masterpiece sort of accomplishments, but I don't know if Soderbergh has that. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but that's sort of part of why I'm so interested with him, is that he's made a lot of really, really good movies, but I don't know if he's made a lot of kind of great, great ones.
You know, what's funny about that is he has a lot of films that at first glance I would dislike, and I would kind of say, oh, this is a lesser quote-unquote Soderbergh, and then I would find myself just thinking about them and turning them over in my mind and trying to decide, did I really dislike that or did I just misjudge it? And a lot of times I'd go back and I'd realize, oh no, I did in fact just not look at it from the right angle, and I didn't sort of consider it as almost like a puzzle piece in this auteurist picture that he's been building throughout his career. Because I think that starting with The Girlfriend Experience and going onward, with the exception of And Everything Is Going Fine, which is sort of like a detour, which is not to discount it, it's a good film, but it's sort of like a detour in terms of these films he's been making about identity in the modern world and the way people present themselves and the way people sell themselves and how they make a living. I feel like The Girlfriend Experience and Haywire and Magic Mike could almost make a weird unofficial trilogy of films that inform each other and complement upon each other, which is what makes it more interesting, is that he's doing this in a generally mainstream landscape with the exception of The Girlfriend Experience, which is a smaller picture. But I mean, Haywire and Magic Mike were big movies that opened wide, but they have these fascinating ideas that are embedded in them and that complement upon things that have come before and things that are going to follow. So, I mean, I think that, yeah, you say he might not have like a specific masterpiece, which might be true, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I would almost take what he does in terms of the way his films fit together than having, you know, two or three truly, truly great, great films.
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting too. We've talked about the mainstream and non-mainstream cycles of his career, but I think too, we've mentioned too that he stopped writing his own films and he started shooting on digital. And I think there's really this point where he started finding a new aesthetic, like you said, also to complement these themes. Because I think because the fact that he directs, shoots, and edits all his films means that he's pretty much in complete control of the visual grammar of these films. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, like something, for example, like Blimey, which is he kind of reconfigured it all in the editing room. I think that's the story behind it, right?
Yeah, like they were in the editing room, and I guess he thought he had a disaster on his hands because it was a pretty rote, stale film that had nothing special about it. And then they just figured, oh, let's sort of have this, you know, let's have this different editing scheme that gave the movie its flavor.
Yeah, and I feel like, well, the film we're going to review tonight, I feel like that's a I kind of have a hunch something similar happened with that film too. Because I really feel like there's, I can see kind of, you can see that kind of skeleton of a script, but there's this way I see just through kind of the Soderbergh direction, the Soderbergh cinematography, the Soderbergh editing, the Soderbergh themes, I feel like he kind of completely reconfigured it in a way. We'll get into it when we review the film, but.
Yeah, well, I haven't said anything yet, so I guess I should jump in. Yeah, I guess I'm kind of with Danny. I like almost everything that Steven Soderbergh does, and he's a very good director. He elevates the material so much. Like, he took Haywire and made it into one of the more interesting films that I had seen that year. And it's a pretty rote story with a very weird central performance, but it's just his style and his flavor is all over it, and it's so good. But I don't know if I could name one of his films as like his out and out masterpiece, or just even as something that's really like fascinating and really unqualifiably good. I think I have an issue, even in his films, which I love, with every single one of them. Like there's a drawback to each of them for me. I don't know why that is. I honestly have no idea what it is about maybe his style or the way that he creates films that he just always misses out on one element that kind of holds me back from really getting into them. So I guess I'm kind of ambivalent on him, but more towards the positive if I have a gun to my head.
One thing to sort of go back to this idea of him becoming more popular in recent years, one of the things I find funny about the fact that movies like Haywire and Magic Mike kind of made a lot of money is that most of the people I know who aren't really kind of hardcore movie lovers that have seen those movies don't like them. So I feel like there's this kind of funny contradiction where, you know, something with Haywire and Magic Mike, obviously like the subject matter and the way they were marketed got people into the theater. But a lot of people I've talked to don't like the movies because they're not what they expected. You know, they're kind of better.
Same with one of his biggest hits, Contagion, which is a movie that has become sort of an HBO staple for me, where by which I mean I see it on and I just put it on for 20 minutes or so and I'm completely engaged, but then I realize I have to go do something else and I just see that section every week, or I see one section every week. And but the thing is that the movie is, I think, goes far, far past the typical disaster thriller that you would sort of, that I think a lot of people went into that movie expecting. And it's not, I don't blame them for expecting that, because that's exactly how it was marketed and that's what you'd expect. But the movie's actually much more interesting than that. And there are a lot of deeper, more relevant things going on under the surface, just directly under the surface. And the thing is, I think that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that this film is commenting upon, for instance, a person's relationship to modern communication, for instance. But because his movies aren't really advertised as these, they're not advertised as that, people go in and they walk up feeling weirdly dissatisfied with them.
Yeah, I didn't really like Contagion that much. So I can't really add anything to your understanding of that. It's just, I appreciated what it was trying to do. And I did appreciate the fact that it went so far beyond what you'd kind of been led to expect from like an outbreak type of marketing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, man. Every one of his movies comes with a qualifier for me. And it's just like Contagion, I just felt like was too spread out, too sprawling, too. It had its attention in so many places that I never really connected with anyone in it. So it never got above the level of like kind of interesting.
See, I kind of felt that way when I first saw it. But watching it again in bits and pieces, I realized how much that film is reliant upon the modern media to connect the people in the story, which I found completely engaging, in which I actually that approach to connecting the different stories, this is just one example, but that was something that I found far more interesting and far more stimulating than just sort of a typical narrative of people who know each other, for instance. And the thing is that you don't, because you're not necessarily expecting that from the movie, I think that a lot of people, when they see it, they kind of think to themselves, oh, this isn't what I want. And I give him a lot of credit for going for that and not, you know, for not playing it easy or playing it safe in a mainstream landscape.
I don't know. Maybe I'll have to watch it again when it's on HBO.
Well, I'd like to actually bring up, one of his most controversial films, which would be Ocean's 12.
What does everyone Ocean's here 12. Think of that one?
I love the scene of Vincent Cassel doing his like breakdance through the. There's so many moments in that movie that I kind of enjoy, but it is so bizarre and like beyond the pale. Some of the things that it does and places it goes. It's very meta, and I don't know if it's meta in a good way.
And here things get meta.
Oh yeah. I don't know. What were other people's thoughts on it?
I haven't seen that since it came out in the theater, which was a while ago now, over 8 years ago, when I was a younger person. But I remember, even though I was younger than I care to admit at the time. But even then, I remember walking out. I remember walking out very angry at the film. Even at that young age, I really felt like I had just really wasted my time. And I say that as someone who really loved Ocean's 11 back then. I mean, I still do, but you know, at the time, I was really excited for it because I loved Ocean's 11, and then Ocean's 12 was something completely different, and that was not what I was expecting. Kind of what I was speaking to before, and I hated it. But in the years since, some people have reappraised it as a truly great film, and I intend to rewatch it fairly soon to kind of see what's going on.
See, yeah, I think it's so much fun. And I mean, I guess people are angered because the whole point of the movie is that it essentially kind of makes fun of the idea of a sequel, why we go to see these movies. We sort of think it's a heist movie. It really, we're just here to see celebrities mingle. And I think even George Clooney said that he was like embarrassed by the movie or something. And that like, I think the other cast member said they were like drunk for most of the filming. And I kind of like that. That's what I like about the film. These films, they're just, the trilogy at least, they're just, I think Soderbergh has even said himself, they were just a complete playground for him basically to do whatever he wanted. And I think, again, I see why people don't like it, but I think it is such a breezy, fun movie. Again, it's been years since I've seen it, but I'd still like to see it again because I actually think it might be one of my favorites of his.
That's weird. Maybe I need to watch it again because, like, I do not remember being a fan so much of that film in its totality. I think I remember liking Ocean's 13 more.
No,
it's pretty good as well.
Yeah, I can't. My issue now, though, is trying to think back. I remember nothing about Ocean's 13. I remember Al Pacino, right? And some sort of mining operation.
There's this subplot where Casey Affleck and the Khan son are in Mexico.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And like they lead a revolution of some kind.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah. Holy shit. Yeah, I need to see that movie again. And like,
more satisfying on screen revolution than the 4 hours of Che, actually.
This is funny because, like, even his, like, I've just mentioned like two films of his that I wasn't fond of. And then in talking about them, I'm just like, yeah, I should watch those again. Like, what the hell is wrong with me? I mean, that's just the kind of director he is, I guess. Like, I'm not going to write him off, and I am interested in continuously going back to his work to see it again. Because, you know, at the very least, it's not like a lazy, shoddy piece of shit. It's usually just an interesting misfire. So, yeah, I think that's what I like about him. He's fully committed to everything that he does.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Do we have any final thoughts to throw out before we talk about his newest film?
I'm happy that there's at least one more thing coming from him, which is Behind the Candelabra. I believe that's how you pronounce that.
I thought it was Candelabra.
Sure, yeah. I don't know. I'm not familiar with the item. But
you're not familiar with a candelabra?
No, I'm not. Really?
This is weird. Okay, I didn't call you out on it earlier, but I'm going to call you out on it now because okay. I remember you talking about how I pronounced Renaissance, and I probably just did it again. You pronounced it contagion too.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, you did, man.
Yeah, you did.
I pronounced it contagion.
Contagion, and now it was like calendarlibra.
Oh
God.
Are you drunk? It's okay.
No, I'm not. I'm fine.
Okay. Anyway, yes, I'm interested and excited to see that movie as well.
Yeah, the Liberace.
However it's pronounced. All right. Yeah. So final thoughts. I guess that is all. So let us now enter into our main review of Side Effects, directed by Steven Soderbergh, starring Channing Tatum, Rooney Mara, and Jude Law.
Get us back to where we were, and I promise I can make that happen.
You remember this beautiful lady here?
Hi.
How have things been going with you?
I can finally sleep. I have some energy. We had sex.
Whoever makes this drug, you're going to be rich.
911, what's your emergency?
I need help.
Someone's been murdered.
There's been an incident.
What do we do?
No sign of forced entry. No sign of struggle.
Where's her lawyer?
She doesn't have one. Just kept talking about you.
So, Side Effects, directed by Steven Soderbergh, written by Scott Z. Burns, who also wrote Contagion. And as I said, this is starring Jude Law, Channing Tatum, Rooney Mara, as well as a number of other people, one of whom is Catherine Zeta-Jones, which is, I don't remember the last time I saw her, and I'd forgotten she was in this movie, and I was just like, oh, it's Catherine. What's she been up to? So we're going to do this like we usually do. We're going to give our brief overall impressions, no spoilers, and then we're going to hop into spoilers to talk about the twisty-turny plot at the heart of this enigmatic film. I think that they actually did a really good job in the marketing, not letting on too much as to what the story of this film was going to be, and I appreciated that.
Yeah.
So, Ethan, why don't you kick us off? What are your thoughts on this film?
Well, Side Effects, new Steven Soderbergh, Rooney Mara, Channing Tatum, Jude Law, Catherine Zeta-Jones, killer cast, where can he go wrong? It almost sounds like a preface to a joke where I said I didn't see the movie. But, Side Effects, okay. I quite like the movie. I'll say going in, I knew there was going to be some point where there would be a twist, or quote unquote twisty twist, where I was worried throughout the movie. I kept thinking, there's a point, I'd say halfway through, where there's a twist, one of many twisty twists, and I was like, oh, is this the worst that's gonna happen? This is pretty good. And then another twist follows, and I was still on board, because I think, like I said, I have a theory about this film, but I think a large part of it was basically reconstructed in the editing room. And I think that, in a way, I had a friend who said this kind of feels like it could be a Brian De Palma movie. And I think, yeah, underneath sort of the kind of cold exterior of this movie, there's a very kind of strange comedy of sorts. There was a guy in the theater laughing. And maybe there's a disconnect between Soderbergh and the actual script in Soderbergh, because Soderbergh has a very kind of icy approach, like I said. But I think that this film, like I said, it's a real testament to his talent. I think the film's use of montage, the film, and in the way the film is kind of it's a network narrative of sorts, like Contagion. But the thing is, the movie's always kind of keeping you on your toes. In fact, this is going to be a very hard movie to talk about without getting into spoilers. But I'll just say I felt there was a theme to about the first hour and a half of the film, and it made me seriously consider this idea about modern living. But then the film switches gears and made me realize that idea was a complete, not a joke, but it certainly pulls the rug underneath you and from under you. Sorry, that's wrong. And I was kind of like, oh, what is this? So I'm kind of questioning the true tone of this film, and I'm still figuring it out. But at the moment, I think it's a very strong formalist work from Steven Soderbergh. Again, I'm kind of, this is very hard, I find, to talk without getting into spoilers. That's why I'm kind of
talking very
dissembling.
Yeah. But someone else can get into it just so it's easier to talk about, I guess, and we can just get into spoilers.
All right, Nick.
So side effects, I am the I saw this before anybody else on the podcast. I saw it I guess almost 3 weeks ago now.
Yeah,
so I've had the most time to sit on it. And this is a movie I've struggled with a lot. I wrote my review of it, and I might as well say I gave it a C+. And that was a grade that actually only came about sort of over the course of about 12 hours or so, where I walked out of the theater and I thought, okay, that's a B, I guess. And then I was walking through Manhattan, I thought, that's a B minus. And then as I was writing review, I said, okay, this is, I'm going to give this a C+, but I'm going to give it a C+ for Soderbergh, because the thing about this film is that for the first, I keep saying this, but I keep saying this because it's just worth repeating. For the first hour, it's completely, completely brilliant. And it is among the best things he's ever made. And I was so in love with it, and I just couldn't believe it was this good. Because I had a feeling it was going to be, a quality picture, but I wasn't expecting it to be quite this good. But it goes into this territory. There's a scene in the film that's set inside a police officer's sort of like office area, a detective's office area. I'm sure we know what I'm talking about an hour into the movie, after a videotape has been watched, so that should tell you. Yeah. And there's a plot development. There's some lines of dialogue. And at that moment, I thought to myself, okay, this is an interesting red herring, because it's not going to go there. Why would it, right? This movie is so much smarter than that. And it's not just that it went there, but it went, quote unquote, there, and then it went several places past that into a zone that I never would have predicted, and that I was just praying it would never venture into, because I figured the film was much smarter than this. You know, we can talk about the film and the incredible filmmaking from Soderbergh and the interesting themes of it, but at its heart, this is a very stupid movie. This is a very, very stupid film. And it was disheartening to watch the movie, what I feel crumble before my eyes, because I think that there are interesting ideas that are embedded in the first two acts of the movie, but they sort of become irrelevant at the end, because they can't reconcile with the narrative. They become these two separate pieces, and there's a scene right toward the end where I gave up. I couldn't go with it anymore. I couldn't abide what was happening, because it turned into a Skinamax thriller, I think. And I'm sorry to say that. I hate to say that, because I love Soderbergh and I loved what this movie was doing, but it didn't congeal, I'm afraid.
And Danny?
All right. Well, I'll start with responding to something Ethan said, which is that the movie kind of has a De Palma feel to it. And to me, I felt that, but I sort of felt it maybe more prominently through Hitchcock, just because the film opens with this kind of establishing shot that slowly kind of gets closer and closer to this window in an apartment building. And it's a lot like the opening shot of Psycho. And there's a lot of kind of twists in the narrative that reminded me of Psycho and sort of like a typical Hitchcock movie. And that's kind of how I saw the movie overall, is just this really kind of fun Hitchcock movie directed by Steven Soderbergh. And I think what Nick is saying in terms of this is a stupid movie, the way I would interpret that is, if you were to tell this story linearly, it wouldn't be interesting. But the way Soderbergh and Burns kind of structure this story and mess with us, and, you know, like Ethan said, maybe some of that's in the script, maybe some of it's how Soderbergh edited it. But I think it's just a fascinatingly structured film. And I think that the sort of genre elements of the script sort of allow Soderbergh to do a lot of interesting things behind the camera. When I sort of compare it to Magic Mike from last year, Magic Mike was a film that had a really great script. And I feel like there wasn't kind of a need for Soderbergh to do too much to make it a really good movie. With Side Effects, he sort of has to kind of really do a lot to keep us in it. And I think he does a lot of interesting things with the camera in a sort of sinister way, while retaining this kind of black humor, especially as the film gets into its latter portions. So overall, I could kind of see kind of both aspects of the opinion so far, but I'm definitely more positive.
Can I just jump in here?
Yeah, sure.
I have to comment on two things. First of all, yeah, I do agree. The camera work, quote unquote, that sounds kind of like a sort of like a layman's term. The camera work. No, the cinematography in this movie is really spectacular. And I was one of the things that drew me in so much was his use of camera racking and how it complemented the narrative and the thematics. We actually talked about this last week when we reviewed Wrong.
I was about to say, I'm sure that was a great relief for you.
How I railed against the film because of the way it was very poorly shot, I thought. Whereas this is just masterful in the way that he's introducing characters through the use of focus, which was just, oh God, it's beautiful. I mean, this is some of the best cinematography I think I've seen in years. And I say that as someone who hasn't always been on board with Soderbergh's digital aesthetic. I thought it worked in Magic Mike, but it wasn't that noticeable, whereas Haywire I thought looked kind of cheap. Actually, no, I think Haywire looks very cheap. You know, Contagion was sort of a mixed bag because it sort of jumps all over the world and whatnot. But yeah, I think that this is it's one of his best showings, I think. But also, so I got a little long there, but I have to ask, I mean, do you think this film is that nonlinear? I think it's a pretty linear film structurally.
It's a linear film, but the way that the narrative is revealed, I think, causes it to feel as though it is not.
I think I could probably answer that more specifically in spoilers.
Yeah. That's gonna be a runner, I feel like.
I'll definitely answer that.
Okay. Sure. If we can let me give my opinion, we can then get into spoilers. I'm having a real hard time just getting words out today, apparently. Keep getting pushed to the side. But it's cool. You all are smart. I probably am going to be the person who is most positive about this film, it seems. We already talked about the cinematography and the music as well. There's a real palpable tone of, I want to say, stress or tension. It's a very thick atmosphere that the film makes, and it's one of the best exercises in atmosphere building that I feel like I've seen in quite a while. And the performances are also uniformly wonderful. I, for some reason, really like Jude Law, and I say it like that because I really can't articulate when or why. Like, there wasn't a single performance that he's done where I was like, yes, I'm going to be on this man's side forever, but I'm always happy to see him in a film and for the film to treat him as almost like a secondary protagonist, or, you know, pulling him towards the forward, towards being like the actual protagonist.
He's the first credited actor, which I thought was kind of curious.
That is curious.
Which becomes more clear as it goes on, but at first that was, yeah.
You know, it's no spoiler to say that he's important to the story. I feel like you could get that from the trailer. But I mean, I was great to see him there. He brought a good game. Rooney Mara was fantastic. Everyone was fantastic. I think that, yeah, the movie has an issue in the third act that we can get into. But I was kind of cool with it. I was okay with it becoming this other film in front of my eyes. And I feel like the kind of blindsidedness that you get, just not seeing it coming and just feeling as though almost it comes out of nowhere, really actually plays into the story of the film rather well. So I've only seen it. I only got out of it about an hour or two ago. So maybe my thoughts will turn a little more sour. But, you know, usually I don't need to sit on Soderbergh a while to understand how I felt about him. And, you know, I feel like I really enjoyed this film. I enjoyed it a whole hell of a lot. And I was entertained. And I do have a qualifier, though. It does slow down a little bit. And it drags a little bit in the center. But, as I said, the performances and I think the story and the characters are enough to pull you through that for when it kind of ramps up towards the end. So those are my thoughts. It's going to be incredibly hard to either attempt to defend or take down this film without really getting into spoilers. So does anyone have any final spoiler-free thoughts they want to throw out first?
Well, let's dish about the performances, huh?
Okay, we can dish.
Even the performances, I feel like I need spoilers.
Right.
So, yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, you can say some things. I mean, I think Rooney Mara, between this and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is the last movie I saw her in, and it seems like that was probably the last movie she was in, right?
I think, yeah, I was trying to think of that, and I'm pretty sure that that's the last film she was in.
not that it's a huge gap, but still, I guess it was in the last film I saw her in. I just think between these two films, she's really shaping up to be one of the best actresses of her generation, which sounds like a kind of a silly buzz term, but it is true. She's absolutely terrific. And I was thinking to myself as I was watching the movie that this sort of feels like the first role where she's able to really kind of stand on her own in a way, because she's not playing this iconic, well, now sort of iconic character like Lisbeth Salander, for instance. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't kind of, it's a more low key role. And I think in that sense, it almost requires more of her, even though she doesn't have to get her nipples pierced. As far as I know, I don't know what the process of this movie was, but that's what stood out to me the most about her work here, is that it has to be more subdued and she has to play it at a lower key, but she does it perfectly. And I think that she is, how would I put it? I think that one of my problems with the movie is the fact that it shifts toward Jude Law, who is also great here, but was not just wasn't quite as interesting to watch, I thought, because it is a character that we've seen Jude Law play before, and he can play it very well, but it's not as interesting to watch, I feel.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it feels like a character that was written for Jude Law in a way. It kind of reminded me of his turn in Contagion in some way. What?
Did you say that as a joke, or is that really just how you say Contagion?
maybe I just don't know how to pronounce that word.
Wait, say cool?
Cool?
Say whip.
Come on. I'm not...
Anyway,
How do you say... Aggression, how do you say Contagion?
It's just contagion, isn't it?
Contagion.
You're really putting an emphasis on the I, which a lot of people just kind of leave out of the equation.
Like contagion?
Just say it really fast. Contagion.
Contagion.
There.
Okay.
Like, do you say demonstration?
No.
Right. It's demonstration.
Yeah.
It's contagion. Yeah. Right.
This is great, great podcast.
I just had to know. I had to know. And if, yeah, anyway, I disagree. I think that his role in this is very different from his role in Contagion. I'm going to be really self-conscious every time I say that word now. In Contagion, he's like malicious and like a conniving son of a bitch. And in this film, he really is like just a decent guy caught up in some stuff.
It's funny because I was thinking about this. I was thinking about comparing Steven Soderbergh and David Fincher, how David Fincher in a lot of his films has sort of the main character is like the obsessed person, and there's always like these montages dedicated to them like processing data. And again, we'll get into this too, in this film it's about a lot of it is montage and people as forms of data. And I was thinking about this, how I guess this is spoilers kind of, but how his character feels like that kind of obsessive David Fincher protagonist, at least when the film shifts, now that a lot of the film's form revolves around him kind of being lost within all these pieces of information and whatnot. But maybe we'll just save that more for
spoilers.
Yeah. All
right. Okay, so we should just get into spoilers, right?
Yeah, also Channing Tatum is playing such a Channing Tatum character.
He's so Channing in this movie.
Great, great fedora.
I fucking hated that fedora. I hate the tiny brimmed fedoras, and it looked like it was like three sizes too small for his head. Oh, god damn it. But he's Channing Tatum at his Channing Tatum-iest.
I always enjoy that.
I enjoy it. It's not.
So do I. I didn't say it's a bad thing. It was just sort of, it felt like a role that was definitely written with him in mind, is all I'm saying.
Yeah. One of the first movies that I reviewed for the film stage when I was a cub starting out, so I just took whatever I could get, was The Vow with him and Rachel McAdams. And so, like, I just, like, he's such like a good and decent man in that film, and I think that has informed my opinion of him in every other film that I've watched. Because in this, I'm like, oh, he's being that nice guy from The Vow. I'm like, fucking shit. Why is that movie still in my head?
Wow.
It's annoying.
It informs your opinion of Channing Tatum as a person.
I'm sure I'm going to, like, if I were ever to run into him, I would not know what to say. Because I'm just like, he's such a good guy.
He seems like a good guy.
He seems like a fantastic person. Like, I might have a man crush on Channing Tatum. I don't understand. Like, he's just such like a charismatic presence, and he just seems like a really awesome guy. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. I think Soderbergh knows how to use him much better than pretty much anybody else, which maybe isn't saying a whole lot, but you know, he has been doing some great work with him.
Yeah, it's an interesting partnership. And I mean, like, if you were to look at Channing Tatum 7 years ago, I don't think you would have seen it coming, but it's interesting how well it's worked. Anyway, let's do it. Let's get into some spoilers. So the movie begins, and it's like a drama. It's a dramatization of a woman who's struggling with depression and kind of the world that she has to live in, bouncing from doctor to doctor and struggling with the side effects of all the medication she's on. And then the tragedy that befalls her when the side effects of sleepwalking causes her to accidentally murder her husband.
Dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun, dun.
Audible gasps in the theater when she did it.
Really? That was kind of clear from the beginning.
I think it was, I kind of knew it was coming, but I just like, I don't know. But this is what I'm talking about. The tone, the palpable tension and the dread in there. I mean, like, I knew it was coming. I was pretty sure I knew what was going to happen. But they did such a good job of still ratcheting up the tension.
I was totally shocked by that, by the way, just to mention that.
You were actually totally shocked.
Yeah, like my jaw hit the floor and like stayed there for like 45 seconds.
Wow. Damn.
Yeah.
So it got Danny. So.
Yeah.
but yeah, so that happens. The doctor is embroiled in this scandal because they decide to really take it to task the pill that she was on, Oblixa. And you know, he gets forced out of his firm, his psychiatric firm. He gets dropped from a project he was working on with a drug company. He becomes basically poison to everyone around him. But he believes in his own lack of culpability and begins to doubt the story that Emily has been pushing forward on all these people. And he comes to the realization that she was faking everything as a means of killing her husband and then shorting the stock of the company that created the pill so that she could reap a windfall. And then he figures it out, and through some various machinations, he is able to turn the tables and get his life back. The end.
Right.
So yeah, it's really weird. Like, it doesn't come out of nowhere, but it goes so far beyond what you thought it was going to be. Like I said, I found the shift interesting. I felt a little bit cheated because it's one of those things where like someone has a plan and they have to do things in order to make the plan work. But they're putting on affectations when no one else is around. You know what I mean? Like they're so in character that like even though it's just us in a room with them alone and they could drop the charade, they stick to it at a moment when, you know, there's not really a need to.
Yeah, although I do think in context, perhaps the most interesting scene in the entire movie is one that seems almost, one that seems sort of like a quick interstitial bit is when she's on a subway platform and she's staring at the Oblixa subway ad, and then it looks like she's going to, you know, possibly commit suicide by jumping in front of the moving train, and then the cop pulls her, and then you have an insert shot of his name, and it's kind of a unique name too, and because it was a unique name, this feels like a very, you know, sly move on Soderbergh's part. I was thinking, okay, this clearly is not just another scene. There has to be something. There's something going on here, and then the way that fits into the twist, I quite liked. So that's not necessarily an affectation. I think the movie, one of the most interesting things about it, even though I think it completely degrades by the end, one of the most interesting things is that it is actually very, no matter how ridiculous the twist is, the film is very true to it. It doesn't shy away from it. It doesn't, I don't think it has any narrative cheats, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I can't sit with it because it's so absurd. What happens in this movie, and it's not that I mind an absurd twist. The problem is that I don't think that it fits with what the film had been presenting beforehand, because the movie is really striving to have this realistic, real world, this could happen to anybody sort of story about a woman who devolves because of the side effects of these pills. And it's very affecting in that way, but that's completely undermined by the end.
It's
when
true,
it turns
yes.
into, oh, this is just every other thriller you've ever seen. So forget it. Don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. This is just a woman who's pretending to be crazy. And I can't reconcile the fact that they would go in that direction because it feels too easy. It feels too familiar. And it's troubling.
Well, I did feel, like you said, in the first half of the movie, I was actually, like I said, I was taking kind of seriously this movie, this as a film about, you know, prescription drugs, pharmacies, corporations, depression in the 21st century. Yeah. And I think when the movie actually shit became that, and it made me say, okay, no, it's not about that. It made me reconsider maybe this, like I brought up Ocean's 12 earlier. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of thinking this is a very, like I said, it's a very cold movie on the surface, but underneath it's kind of just the point of the entire movie is to constantly subvert your expectations, to have fun with what you think is serious, what you don't think is serious and whatnot. And again, maybe I think, like I said, I don't think about the movie, I don't know if it makes complete sense on a narrative level, but also on the other hand, I think if we just want to even just get this more out in the open here, the lesbian turn, that's what we're all referring to, right?
Yeah. When you
think about it, it takes up a pretty small part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very weird, like, they went, I think this is what, there's so many twists, and yeah, the lesbian angle, I felt a little weird by that. I was like, really? Like, De Palma, like, came up before. That's completely and utterly correct. Like, all right, I guess this is happening now. And it was almost absurd, the amount of stuff that was happening. But I was still into it. I don't know.
Right, you go first.
I was going to say, I have to ask somebody, do you really think that the film becomes smarter than it was beforehand when you get to Catherine Zeta-Jones and Rooney Mara passionately making out? I mean, okay, I'll be frank. I did enjoy that. I enjoyed the sight and sound of that scene, but I was also
artistically.
It's kind of weird that you highlight the sound of that scene too.
Well, okay, well, but still, I can't imagine somebody looking at that and thinking to themselves, yes, this is the ultimate realization of everything that has come before. This is perfect. This is a great encapsulation. This is the, I was going to say climax, but I realized that's sort of inappropriate. it's hard to look at that and think to myself that this is an appropriate direction for the movie to have gone in, because it doesn't match with what has come before. And it goes from being a pretty straight line thriller into something that, you know, we've used this word a lot, more twisty, which I like. I like twisty films. I like films that become something different than what they were at the beginning, but I like when they do that and they remain consistent, which I don't think Side Effects does. And, you know, if the movie is meant to be having some fun, great. I mean, I was having fun with it to begin with. And even at the end, I was having some fun, but it's just not enough for me. I feel like the film is smarter than going in that direction.
All right. I can chime in here with a few things. I'll start with the acting, which was sort of mentioned a little bit before we got into spoilers. But one of the things that this film sort of does well as a final theatrical film for Soderbergh is it sort of reminds us how good he's been with actors and how good he's been with actors that other people haven't necessarily been as good with. Like we mentioned Channing Tatum, and obviously this film isn't a showcase for him, but just their relationship is one of many in Soderbergh's career where he's sort of brought up as actors kind of through his films. I think that Jude Law is another one, because this film, he essentially becomes the main character and he's the dominating presence in the second half. And I can't really remember the last time Jude Law had a really solid role that wasn't supporting. I think he's been great in a lot of films, but I don't know if he's had this much screen time in a while.
For Hugo.
Hugo is a huge role.
That's a joke, obviously.
Yeah. And Catherine Zeta-Jones also in Traffic, probably, you know, one of her best performances. She hasn't been in a lot of movies. So there's that, the performances. And I agree with that Rooney Mara is also very good. To get to the narrative, to sort of defend the structure of this movie, what it is what I meant by the linear story is that it's sort of about this girl whose husband gets arrested, and then she falls in love with this shrink and then tries to kill the husband to get money with this lady shrink. And that's just kind of a stupid, silly story. I think the structure does a lot of interesting things. And one of the things I like best is that the first 45 minutes to an hour sets up this story in which pills and drugs are sort of these forces that these people can't handle. But in the end, it's sort of a story about how just basic human situations can be just as powerful, if not more powerful, because, you know, the thing that really drives Rooney Mara's character crazy is losing her husband and losing that financial security. It has nothing to do with drugs that no one knows the side effects of. So I think that's sort of a cool thing that the structure does mm-hmm. that the story wouldn't have done otherwise.
Right. But you have to travel through something that is by no stretch a basic human situation.
Right. But then I don't think if you were to tell this story like I said it in order, it would be worth telling.
Yeah, so I guess I just don't think it's worth telling in this particular order either.
Well, again,
No, I was just laughing at Nick.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, that this is the best possible version of this story, but that's kind of what you just said back, but go ahead.
Well, again, as I said, when I was saying that I feel like Soderbergh reconstructed this film a lot, when you think about what a lot of this film is, a lot of it is kind of, it's just process. Like I said, it's montage. It's people kind of going through mundane things. There's a lot of insert shots of people holding things, people taking pills and whatnot. So it's sort of like, I feel like he's reducing everything into data, everything into just pieces. And that's why I feel like he makes this film very cold. He makes it very icy. That's where I say he kind of reconstructed the film in the editing room to me. Where I think that, again, I think if anyone else had directed it, I think the twist it takes at the end would be actually a huge problem. It would be where it would lose me.
Yeah. Just to sort of mention the procedure aspect again, the film sort of has this contagion vibe to me in spots where it's sort of about, you know, like the pharmaceutical industry and medicine and stuff like that. But there's also kind of these interesting scenes with Jude Law interacting with cops. And one of them might be like a district attorney or something. But I just sort of enjoy this idea of we're really on Jude Law's side from the beginning because he seems like a smart shrink and a nice guy. You know, I don't think there's anything you could say about him that's negative. But when he's sort of interacting with these police figures, they see him as this kind of snobby shrink that's sort of lazy with his job and gives people pills that don't need them and stuff like that. And it was just kind of this fun experience where he would be sitting in an interrogation room, and just by the suit he wears, you could tell that the people he was talking to just hated him. I think he could change that. And it's interesting because we've seen him from the beginning and he's a nice guy. And he is, even at the end, after he does all these horrible things, at least to me. And so that was kind of a cool aspect.
Yeah, I love the fact that, and I mentioned this when I was walking out of this film, like this is one of the weird films that somehow completely is able to get you on the side of someone who is doing something viciously amoral. Like he is abusing the strictures of law and medicine, but I'm totally fine with him doing it. Like in it, if, and it's just weird because, you know, you see someone doing something like that and you're like, he shouldn't be abusing his power in that way. He's doing terrible things. He's kind of basically drug and prescribe this person and imprison this person, but you're totally cool with it. I have no problem with what he does. Am I the only one who felt that way?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it would be very easy for, and I'm sure there has been a film like this, you know, to take a person doing what he's doing and make him the villain. You know, like this poor woman who's being just destroyed because some vicious doctor is, you know, playing havoc with her and no one will believe her. And it's like, yeah, that's what he's doing. But, you know, she kind of deserves it, which is awful to say out loud.
Well, that's what I mentioned that I was hesitant to kind of get into the acting before we were in spoiler territory, but this is, yeah, definitely where I want to praise Rooney Mara, because, again, in this film, she has to be, she's sort of constantly being reconfigured by the narrative, who she is, and I think she has this sort of, I'm not saying this as a, I'm saying this as a compliment, she is sort of this naturally kind of, I don't know if blank is the right word to say, but this sort of kind of naturally off, distant quality
to her. Distant is a very good word for it.
Like, I find at times she almost has a strange kind of Monica Vitti-esque quality to her. Ooh. Maybe that's being a little too complimentary. But I like that too, Ben, because, again, it makes sense. Every emotion she's asked to be in this film makes sense for who she is, again, when she's the kind of depressed, distant person. And then later in the film, when she has to be kind of like the sly, sultry seductress who has that kind of interesting presence that could lead you off. Again, that's just where I finally want to give some praise to Rooney Mara.
Yeah, she has this ability to be like kind of vague but not boring.
Yeah, exactly.
Vague in a way that kind of makes you sit up and be like...
Enigmatic is the word I would use.
What the hell's going on in your head?
Yeah, I would call her enigmatic, I think is a good way to say you know, vague and affectless, mm-hmm. but in a good way.
And that vagueness definitely complements the screenplay too. It emboldens it, I think, in a way that the screenplay does not embolden itself, I would say. It is... Yeah, I mean, to say it's the most important performance in the film kind of goes without saying because it, because it is the lead, quote unquote, sort of. Hold on a second, there are people walking by me. Sorry about that. I'm recording in like a lobby right now, so.
That's weird.
Yeah, don't ask. Anyway, so yeah, I think that, you know, she's the lead performance, so of course it is sort of the most important, so to speak, but it is the most important also because of the way it fits into the film's mold the most strongly, whereas I think, like I said, Jude Law and Channing Tatum feel sort of familiar in a way, even though that's not bad because I like them both. This is by far the most interesting work going on here, and it is the one that I've considered the most in the time since I've seen it, whereas I don't think that the other characters are interesting enough, or at least quite interesting enough, to warrant that sort of thought.
Again, I'm really on the side of Jude Law, so... But no, you can't overstate how important and how good Rooney Mara is. But yeah, still a fan of Jude Law. I liked his character a lot. But
it's just funny how she's sort of making a name for herself playing sociopaths.
Yeah, she's
I appreciate.
It's become her thing. I mean, she's good at it. she's come a long way since the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street.
And the opening scene of The Social Network.
Yes.
This is just a funny anecdote from my screening. Remember that scene kind of early on where Jude Law is talking to a patient in a foreign language?
Yeah.
And there's no subtitles?
Yes.
That scene was going on, and after about two lines of no subtitles, the people behind me were like bickering, like, what the hell's going on? Like, there's something wrong with the projection.
Oh, gosh.
And that just, that made me laugh.
That, I have to confess, that's actually why I didn't like the movie. It's because of that scene.
Yeah,
I figured you're pretty lazy. I think we're good though. I think we've come to a natural ending point. I think you should see this film. I enjoyed it. It's there are worse ways to spend your time.
Even though I don't like the movie that much, I say please go see it because it's a fascinating movie, and obviously it's giving you a lot to discuss. And even though a lot of the thoughts since when I saw it about 3 weeks ago have been rooted in frustration, I'm still thinking about the film and I'm turning it over in my mind in a way that I don't think many mainstream films are doing nowadays, which sort of goes back to what we said earlier in the episode when it comes to Soderbergh and how even if you don't like a film of his, it's hard to dismiss it. And this is very much one of those. And hey, I really want to see it again, and I definitely will when it hits the home discs, so I will do that. Perhaps I'll enjoy it more second time.
All right.
I shouldn't have made myself laugh saying home discs.
I'm definitely excited to watch it again on UMD.
Oh, wow, that is an obscure reference.
What?
The PSP movies on your PSP.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
They don't make those anymore. No.
Oh, man. Anyway, yes. So moving on, let's talk.
There.
What?
Now that UMDs have been raised for the first time in the show's history, it might as well put it there.
Or the history of anything ever. Coming to UMDs this week.
There were UMDs in Iraq.
Coming to home video disc, we have The Perks of Being a Wallflower, The Man with the Iron Fists, The Kid with the Bike is coming to Criterion.
Woo!
Woo! The Sessions, which is a movie that got a lot of good buzz. Silent Hill Revelations, Bully.
You're missing the big one.
Dolphin Tail?
Skyfall.
Oh, yes,
Let
Skyfall.
The Skyfall!
The problem with that is that it's actually like sandwiched amongst all these other James Bond films that have... So I just kind of skipped over it.
Being released for the 67th time?
Yeah.
Right.
Seeing a lot of Dalton. Yes, Skyfall is also coming out.
There are two choices there. Anyway, sorry.
So yes, Skyfall, obviously, I'd say check it out. The same with The Kid with a Bike. Anyone else have a... anyone else want to throw out some love for a film that's coming out?
Yeah, Skyfall is as good as any studio film got last year. I thought it was terrific. And Kill with a Bike, also very, very good. I saw that almost a year ago, and it's really stuck with me. I didn't see Wallflower, even though I was...
Did anyone see Perks of Being a Wallflower?
I've seen it.
Yeah, I saw that.
Did you like it?
It's all right.
Okay.
Yeah, I liked it.
All right.
I like the Sessions too.
Yeah, and Man with the Iron Fist, that was a legitimate disappointment.
I remember you saying that was disappointing, so I'm sad about that.
Yeah, I was very much looking forward to it, but man.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same page.
All right. Well, coming out this week to a theater near you, we have A Good Day to Die Hard, the fourth film. Fifth film? This is the fifth film, isn't it? I completely forgot about Live Free or Die Hard. The fifth film in the Die Hard franchise. We also have Beautiful Creatures, which is the newest film to attempt to fill the hole that Twilight left in all of our hearts. Safe Haven, a Nicholas Sparks thing that looks about the same as every other Nicholas Sparks movie. Escape from Planet Earth, which looks god-awful. No, best foreign language Oscar-nominated film.
Terrific movie, just wanted to say.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, after I get done saying what's coming out, you can say which one you think is good. A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III, and Like Someone in Love, Abbas Kiarostami's new film, following a certified copy. Woo! So yeah, obviously I think that if you can, you should see Like Someone in Love. I've heard great things about No. One of them was just seconds ago. So
Oops.
Right.
Yeah. Does anyone have anyone else want to talk about the things that are happening?
Good Day to Die Hard. The first review came out. It was very, very bad.
Really?
Unfortunately. Yeah. But I think I thought I heard some mildly positive things. I don't know. I think I'll maybe see it.
I'm just not a fan of like how much they've built up John McClane. You know, I miss Die Hard John McClane.
Speaking of that, I was in a diner today having dinner, and Live Free or Die Hard was on the TV in the diner, and the lady working there was like, Bruce Willis and Justin Long, what the hell is this? It's reminded me, I feel like the last Die Hard, like nobody even remembers it happened.
Yeah, right. I mean, I completely forgot about it. just talking about how many Die Hards there were.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Beautiful Creatures?
I feel like Die Hard, we'll probably never have a worse installment than Die Hard 2, which I think is pretty bad.
I'd say it's better than the fourth one.
I think it's better than the fourth one.
Yeah.
Really? I hear this a lot. What is so egregious about Die Hard 2?
I think it's a...
It's a retreat. Yeah, I'll admit it.
It's not just that it's a retreat, but it is...
Wait, a retreat? Like it's fleeing? It's
retreat.
A retread?
Yeah.
What the hell is going on, guys?
Okay, I had my contagion moment.
I love it.
Holy shit. What is happening? Oh, Danny, P.S., you said pharmaceutical, not pharmaceutical earlier, too.
Oh, shit.
What is happening?
Can you change that? No one in this show can speak English.
Pharmaceutical.
I swear to God, no one is drunk right now, right?
Like, right. Yeah.
I might be.
Cuticle anyway. Sounds cool.
I blacked out last night, but I'm fine now. I don't know what the hell's going on with the rest of you people. Anyway,
let's get off the subject of
our inability to speak. Safe Haven looks disturbing because just that girl looks 15 and Josh Duhamel looks like 40. So I don't
from
know.
Director Lassie Hellstrom,
he did Gilbert Grape, didn't he?
And probably and everybody on Twitter's favorite movie of last year,
Safe Haven.
Salmon fishing in the Yemen.
Oh, right, yeah. And he did Dear John, so this is his second...
And what has happened to that guy?
I don't know. He did Chocolat and the Cider House Rules. Yeah, this guy's he's on the decline. Anyway, unimportant.
He's sort of like a Swedish Ron Howard.
He's a Swedish Ron Howard.
Ron Howard's probably better now that I think about
Swedish
it.
Swedish Soderbergh, just making crap after... Crap.
He also made Hachi, A Dog's Tale, which I heard things about. I can't recall if they were good or bad. Anyway, I think we can all agree Know and Like Someone in Love, probably the best bets. I'll be checking out Die Hard because I'm a fan, but I'm not guessing that I'll be pleasantly surprised. Anyway, let's do our random recommendations real quick, and then we can let these fine people get on with their lives. So, Danny, why don't you kick us off? What's something you watched recently that you think people should check out?
Well, mine has to be Tommy Wiseau's The Room. absolutely has to be The Room, okay. Even though I watched a lot of good films this week. I saw it for the first time at the Landmark Sunshine in New York City. And it took a while for me to get into it because for the first 15 minutes or so, I was mad at the audience. Because the dialogue was so funny, but they were throwing things and swearing at the screen, so I couldn't really hear it. And so I wanted to try to tell people, like, yo, I get why you're laughing, but I want to, like, hear the jokes.
Trying to follow the plot here.
Yeah. I mean, I was probably, like, one of five people there who hadn't seen the movie before. But, yeah, it's obviously, like, a blast. And since then, I've been watching Tommy Wiseau interviews on YouTube. And he's just pretty hysterical. He always says this thing where he's like, go to the room, have fun, but be safe. Like, he's just this guide for the audience. And one of the funny things about The Room is, like, when it starts with these opening credits and his name comes up, everyone in the audience just goes insane. So it's kind of this, like, cool... I mean, like, if you just think about it, Tommy Wiseau, who is clearly not a good filmmaker... has impacted so many lives so many different times. And it's just sort of this funny idea that all these people who, you know, probably go to the Sunshine regularly to see, you know, movies that are better would kind of pay multiple times to see this movie at midnight and just go nuts with it. And it's kind of a cool cult thing that that's cool.
Your touch put the fire around me.
Be one too many sex scenes.
And the sex scenes are so long, too.
Is that I, for some reason, I'd never heard that, but there were four of them or five of them, and they were all too long.
So long and so graphic, and none of the people are... I mean, Greg Sestero is kind of a hunk, but otherwise...
You're so beautiful, Lisa.
Yeah.
I have yet to see The Room. I know that that's some kind of heresy. They do it. They do it all the time. Like, it plays midnight shows around here. I just
And watching it at home first, and then going. Got to hear every line. It's just
okay. I will attempt to do that.
The Room teaches you more about the importance of certain film aesthetics than I would say Citizen Kane, honestly.
Wow.
Because it teaches you everything that you should not do in a film. Like, just if you were going to go out and make your first feature, just watch The Room and then do the opposite of that.
Okay. So, Nick, then, what is something you watched that we should check out?
Believe it or not, my suggestion is better than Tommy Wiseau's feature.
Impossible.
And I'm going to go with, I think Ethan will be happy with this choice. I'm going to go with Johnny Guitar, directed by Nicholas Ray from 1954. I know you're a... Thank you.
Why is everyone laughing?
No, I just thought that Yay was so sad. No, I know you're a Nicholas Ray fan. So anyway, this is one of the more curious Westerns I think I've probably ever seen because it is you know, if you looked at images from this film and if I told you the plot and described certain scenes, it would sound like a Western, when in fact I think it's much more of a social drama, almost a melodrama.
Psychosexual.
Actually. Yeah, it is a very, again, it's a very curious film starring Joan Crawford and the great Sterling Hayden, as well as Mercedes McCambridge. And it's about this woman who runs a casino in the Old West, and sort of the times are kind of not exactly catching up with her, because the thing is that she's a very progressive woman, shockingly progressive, especially for a Western. Even today, the film would feel strong in its depiction of a woman, and sort of how these different people are coming for her and how the society is collapsing around her in a way. And there's this man, Johnny Guitar, who comes in. I won't describe the plot, because why am I even doing this? It is an incredible film, and I think that it's probably maybe one of the most important Westerns I've ever seen, because it redefines what the genre can do. And the fact that I can say that about something as familiar as the Western speaks volumes. It's a beautiful, beautiful film. I can't remember the last entry into the genre I saw that was so reliant emotionally upon the color of a woman's shirt and how that changes. It's also, I think, probably... It's just, it's fascinating to see how this sort of echoes throughout the genre, and also the lessons that I think a lot of filmmakers did not learn from this movie, unfortunately, because it's doing so many more interesting things than, you know, later films that you'd watch end up doing. And I'm just babbling now because I don't really know how to quantify this film into words. It is just, it's really incredible. Let me leave it at that.
Yep.
All right. And Ethan, your random recommendation.
I'll go with some old school vulgar auteurism here.
Ooh.
Is that the first time that's ever been like said out loud on this show? That term?
Old school vulgar auteurism?
Just vulgar. I can't speak English today.
None of us can. It's okay.
Vulgar auteurism. Has that ever been said like actually out loud on the show before?
The last time you were here, you said it when we discussed Tony Scott.
Yeah,
Tony.
Woo, Tony Scott.
Top Gun 3D. We recommend it. No,
yeah, I saw that. I was like, shit. Why am I going to see Side Effects?
I'm actually considering. But anyway, let's get on here. I will recommend the original, The Nutty Professor, directed by Jerry Lewis, and of course, starring him as well. Of course, I think everyone knows the story because everyone's seen the remake. Or at least the sequel to Clumps, the two Eddie Murphy classics. But
shit.
Basically, what's really impressive about this movie is, I mean, the thing about Jerry Lewis is just, I mean, I think anyone watching any of his movies will tell he's a very, very skilled filmmaker. Just his movies look amazing. And I mean, just talking about Nicholas Ray, this film is also a tremendous display of just color in cinema. But what's amazing too is that his films, they don't just look nice. There's really, he uses form towards creating kind of this real sense of melancholy, I feel, within the film's comedy. And it's interesting considering the fact that his alternate personality, Buddy Love, is sort of modeled after Dean Martin, who, of course, Jerry Lewis was partners with. For his film, so it's sort of like he's kind of taking a look back at himself and his career, and the fact that he has the two sides of him. He has the, you know, the dorky professor, and he has the suave ladies' man. And I think, too, probably what's most important about this film is that it was the influence for the important story arc in Family Matters, where Urkel became Stefan Urkel.
That is a lasting impact that is unrivaled in cinema.
So I don't know if The Nutty Professor is available on American Netflix or not, but definitely add it to your queue.
Excellent.
I've never heard that referred to as an example of vulgar auteurism.
Well, I think, like, again, vulgar auteurism is referring usually more to more contemporary filmmakers, when there's sort of like, again, there's people in their time who are just considered kind of... you know, just kind of like schlocky directors, like
say schlock merchants.
Yeah, I can see that.
My random recommendation is going to be Seven Psychopaths. I got that Blu-ray, and I watched it, and I liked it even more the second time. So yeah, I don't know. That's about it. I mean, we did a whole episode on it. So I feel like if anyone really needs for me to get into more detail, we can just point you in that direction. Has anyone else seen this since we first saw it and talked about it?
No.
Okay.
Did you see it, Ethan?
Yeah, I hated it.
What? Right. What? Ethan. Jesus. Ethan. Get off my podcast. Why did you not like it?
It's so stale.
What?
Just all the satire. It's like so been there, done that.
Oh, you are a madman. You know what? I take back every nice thing I said about you.
Over 7 psychopaths?
What? No, I don't.
No, it's not a film that's worth getting mad
at. No, it's not. It's not like he said that Wrong was the best movie ever.
Right.
And then you would have to disown him.
Oh, by the way.
I mean, it's fine. I have no problem with you not liking 7 Psychopaths. I'm aware that it does have aspects that feel a little trod, but I like it a lot. It's enjoyable.
Oh, by the way, I looked it up. The Nutty Professor is not on American Netflix even to rent, but the Eddie Murphy film is available on Watch Instantly.
Oh, sweet. I know what you're doing tonight. Oh, fantastic.
So,
Is The Clumps?
And it's in HD too. Is The Clumps? No, it's you can rent it, but
I'm gonna get blackout drunk on some scotch and watch The Nutty Professor. Oh boy. Anyway, woo. All right. So yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is it for today. Join us next week when we will be talking about Like Someone in Love, the new film from director Abbas Kiarostami. Before we leave, let's tell you where we can be found on the internet. Ethan, why don't you kick us off?
Twitter.com, Ethan Vest. Really, that's where the action happens. And I've got my Letterboxd account. That's where the action happens, part 2. And sometimes I contribute to thefilmstage.com. That's where the action happens, part 3.
All right. So if you were wondering where the action happens, you got a 3-part answer. Nick, what about yourself?
Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, thefilmstage.com.
And Danny?
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And I can be found at thefilmstage.com as well as twitter.com/BrianJRowan and at my personal blog, dearfilm.net. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe, comment, and rate us. And we will talk to you next week about Like Someone in Love.